Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to A Conservative Perspective. My name is James Bostic. This is our annual D-Day retrospective. We do a few of these each year. We do one for Pearl Harbor Day and one for D-Day. We'll also talk a little bit about the Great Battle at Midway. 79 years ago, on a Tuesday, much like today, CBS broke the news, unofficial, that the invasion had begun. And tonight, we have their words, their stories, and I think that it is important that we join together in preserving this very important thread that runs within the national tapestry of our heritage. As it happened, moment by moment, June 6, 1944, the invasion of Europe.
CBS World News, Bob Trost speaking. And again, we bring you the available reports, all of them from German sources, on what the Berlin radio calls the invasion. There is still no Allied confirmation from any source. The correspondents who rushed to the War Department in Washington soon after the first German broadcast was heard were told that our War Department had no information on the German reports. There's been no announcement of any sort from Allied headquarters in London. The first news of the German announcement reached this country at 12:37 a.m. Eastern Wartime. The Associated Press recorded this broadcast and immediately pointed out that it could be one which Allied leaders have warned us to expect from the Germans. Shortly after 1 a.m. Eastern Wartime, the Berlin radio opened its news program with a so-called invasion announcement. Columbia's shortwave listening station here in New York heard the Berlin radio say, and I quote, "Here is a special bulletin. Early this morning, the long-awaited British and American invasion began when paratroops landed in the area of the Somme estuary. The harbor of Le Havre is being fiercely bombarded at the present moment. Naval forces of the German Navy are off the coast fighting with enemy landing vessels. We've just brought you a special bulletin." End of the quotation. That is the invasion announcement as heard from the Berlin radio by Columbia Shortwave Listening Station. Now here's what Transocean, one of the German news agencies, says, and I quote, "Early Tuesday morning, landing craft and light warships were observed in the area between the mouth of the Somme and the eastern coast of Normandy. At the same time, paratroops were dropped from numerous aircraft on the northern tip of the Normandy Peninsula. It is believed that these paratroops have been given the task of capturing airfields in order to facilitate the landing of further troops. The harbor of Le Havre is at the moment being bombarded. And, continues the broadcast, German naval forces have engaged enemy landing craft off the coast. The Transocean broadcast, still unconfirmed, concludes this way. The long-expected Anglo-American invasion appears to have begun. This is the full text of the German Transocean broadcast as recorded by the Associated Press.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in Thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God.
This is Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour. All night long, bulletins have been pouring in from Berlin claiming that D-Day is here, claiming that the invasion of Western Europe has begun. Let me read you several of the latest bulletins. One says, that a report, unconfirmed by Allied sources, of course, says that heavy fighting is taking place between the Germans and invasion forces on the Normandy Peninsula, about 31 miles southwest of Le Havre. Another bulletin, also from Berlin Radio and unconfirmed, says that British-American landing operations against the western coast of Europe, from the sea and from the air, are stretching over the entire area between Cherbourg and Le Havre, a distance of about 60 miles. I repeat, there is no confirmation. And here's another bulletin just in. DNB, the German agency, says, this is unconfirmed, that the most important airdromes in the area of the Normandy Peninsula of France have been wiped out. Now, I presume that means wiped out by the Allies. As you may have heard on earlier broadcasts, all three German news agencies have begun broadcasting these stories that the invasion is here. But there is no Allied confirmation as yet. The first report came out shortly after midnight, and since then we've been flooded with reports from Berlin. Paris Radio, strangely enough, has not confirmed any of these reports. And now we have just been informed that we can expect, in a very few seconds, a very important broadcast from the British capital. And so now we take you to London.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is New York, NBC Newsroom again. Men and women of the United States, this is a momentous hour in world history. This is the invasion of Hitler's Europe, the zero hour of the Second Front. The men of General Dwight Eisenhower are leaving their landing barges, fighting their way up the beaches into the fortress of Nazi Europe. They are moving in from the sea to attack the enemy under a mammoth cloud of fighter planes, under a ceiling of screaming shells from Allied warships. The first news flashes do not say, but a large proportion of this assault is believed to be in the hands of American men. They are making the attack side by side with the British Tommies who were bombed and blasted out of Europe at Dunkirk. Now, at this hour, they are bombing and blasting their way back again.
Shells were bursting everywhere. Men, parts of bodies were flying. These men were hollering. A lot of them were praying. They were praying or hollering, "Mama." That stands out in my mind more than the ones that were dying. The ones that were praying, it would be the ones that was calling their mother. They were calling "Mama." We loaded on them boats and off of them boats for a week or 10 days every day. And each time we would be loaded on, we'd think, well, this is it. And to answer your question, was when we moved out and thousands of planes that sounded like a roar over our head, and hadn't gone very far in that water until we could hear the artillery from the coast, the French coast, then we knew that was the day that it was going to happen. It was heavy fog, and of course the sea was rough in A Company. They were the first ones to hit the Homeyall Beach, and that was the biggest percentage of them were wiped out. One of our chaplains, but it went in on the same boat with me. He used to say, "You try to save I'll try to save the souls. You try to save the lives, and I'll try to save the souls." But see, a chaplain with an outfit, he had to be all, whether he's Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, and all. But he went back and turned to one of the men who fell and hollered for help, and he turned to pick him up, and I don't know what hit him, but his body went and his head wasn't there. Just some things stand out in your mind that you don't try not to think about or talk about too much. I just have been so fortunate then and since then. Was a good family, and tries to thank God every day that, and you know, I'm one of a lot of people say, well, the Lord did this, the Lord did that. I don't think the Lord, well, take this chaplain that I'm talking about. Nobody can never convince me, because he was the only chaplain there to console and pray with these soldiers. I can't be convinced that the Lord jerked his head off and leave him without it.
The sky was black with airplanes, you might say, you know, bombing the beaches, and the ships were out there firing long-range guns, trying to knock out the German gun positions and their Siegfried line. Our role was the combat engineer, carried 50 pounds of ammunition on their chest to go in and demolish any particular obstacles that may be in the way to get the infantry through. We headed to the beach, and we hit a sandbar. And this youngster, we were ready to go, you know, and he said, hold on. He said, we're not in yet. So he pulled back off of the sandbar and drove over and went into the beach where we barely got our feet wet. Other guys in their boats were, as soon as they hit sandbars, they dropped the gate, you know, on the front of the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went in over their heads.
Hmm.
And some didn't make it to the beach.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was the greatest generation, the World War II generation?
That's what they say. That's a matter of opinion, I guess.
But does it matter to you that people just look at you guys in awe?
No, I don't think we did anything special. It was just our turn. You know, we had your World War One and your Civil War and your Spanish-American War. That's just...
Well, we sat in our steel bucket seats, and the takeoff time was 10:41. I can't recall exactly how long the flight was, other than maybe 57 minutes, 59 minutes. Then I moved up to the front, make sure that everybody was alert and awake and cigarettes were out. Now, there's 45 aircraft in a V of V shape. I was in the third one to the right. We were yawing and pitching, trying to get out of away from the flak and all those candleworks coming up at us. That means we got 5 minutes to go. So we got them, the lieutenant got us all standing. And the orders there, stand up and hook up. My armpit got caught in the lower left-hand corner of the door. I normally weighed 137 pounds. That night I weighed 276. So we were spread over 400 square miles. Only 15% of us got together for the first 5 or 6 days.
Ici, non. Les Français parlent aux Français.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. To members of resistance movements, whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, I say, continue your passive resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your lives. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy. The day will come when I shall need your united strength. Until that day, I call on you for the hard task of discipline and restraint. Citizens of France, I am proud to have again under my command the gallant forces of France. Fighting beside their allies, they will play a worthy part in the liberation of their homeland. Because the initial landing has been made on the soil of your country, I repeat to you with even greater emphasis my message to the peoples of other occupied countries in Western Europe. Follow the instructions of your leaders. A premature uprising of all Frenchmen may prevent you from being of maximum help to your country in the critical hour. Be patient. Prepare. As Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, there is imposed on me the duty and responsibility of taking all measures necessary to the prosecution of the war. Prompt and willing obedience to the orders that I shall issue is essential. Effective civil administration of France must be provided by Frenchmen. All persons must continue in their present duties unless otherwise instructed. Those who have made common cause with the enemy and so betrayed their country will be removed. When France is liberated from her oppressors, you yourselves will choose your representatives and the government under which you wish to live. In the course of this campaign for the final defeat of the enemy, you may sustain further loss and damage. Tragic though they may be, they are part of the price of victory. I assure you that I shall do all in my power to mitigate your hardships. I know that I can count on your steadfastness now, no less than in the past. The heroic deeds of Frenchmen who have continued the struggle against the Nazis and their Vichy satellites in France and throughout the French Empire have been an example and an inspiration to all of us. This landing is but the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe. Great battles lie ahead. I call upon all who love freedom to stand with us now. Keep your faith staunch. Our arms are resolute. Together we shall achieve victory.
And together total victory was indeed achieved. Hey, everybody. James Bostic here, Conservatives Perspective on the Mojo 5-0 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you ought to be the very best in conservative and libertarian talk radio out there. What we're doing, this is something I do every year. This is the annual D-Day commemorative program. It's a special with the sounds and listening experiences of that time. And the way I got it figured, these guys are more worthy of talking about than some of the crap that we have been talking about for months now. And we're just going to let the trained professionals talk about that stuff. And we're going to stay in remembrance with America's greatest generation, their words and their voices. It strikes me that the summer of 1944 and 76 years later, the summer of 2020, stand in stark contrast to one another. The country's being ripped apart by the Democrats, by the Marxists. And I'm going to preach this quick sermon, and then we're going to move on because I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. Because it takes away, and I think in some respects, sullies the memory of these great guys and the tribute that I like to try and pay to them every year. And you've seen this with me. If you guys have been listening to the show in its various formats, Independence Day, D-Day, the Battle of Midway, Veterans Day, Pearl Harbor, these things come up a lot. I do shows on those. I remember. Because as a kid, these stories, these guys were gods. They were myths. They were legends. I grew up in the 60s and early 70s, and I had aunts and uncles who were young men and women at the time of the war. I had uncles who fought in the war, and those memories were still, the memories of World War II, that is, were still kind of green. And I suppose a lot of guys my age, you know, were kind of, I don't want to say indoctrinated, but we were exposed to that because so many men fought in the Second World War. And like I said, today is a day that, you know, it's June 7th. We're a day late, but this is how it usually works in the radio business. But anyway, we're paying homage. We're paying tribute to those guys today. And I know there are probably many of you listening to the show can think of your uncles, your aunts who worked in the war effort, or they were nurses, or they were in the military, and maybe they were sent to somewhere on the other side of the world and placed in harm's way, and for the grace of God, maybe they made it back. And got, you know, and you got to share some of those experiences with them. Or maybe they didn't, and all you have is a memory to revere. And that's what we're doing today on a conservative perspective. We're revering the memory of those great men and women, both living and dead, and we're going to continue with that in just a little bit. You know, as I've said many times, you know, the average median age in the United States right now is about 38, almost 39 years old. And a lot of these folks, being in the school business is my regular daytime job, it is dependent upon the history teacher themselves, but a lot of these guys, it just kind of gets glossed over. And a lot of the reasons for that is because the kids that are teaching this stuff nowadays weren't really taught that much of it themselves. We're moving into like the second, maybe third generation where these kind of things are not looked at as they once were. We're just going to take a little time to correct that today. We will be back here in just a little bit. You're listening to A Conservative's Perspective here on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you're not listening, you ought to be, because it is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio you're going to find out there anywhere. And we will return on the other side with more of our D-Day, Normandy Invasion retrospective, right after this.
This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jive. Rootle-de-toot, jump in your suit, make a salute. After you wash and dress, more or less, you go get your breakfast in a beautiful little cafe they call the Mess. Jack, when you convalesce, out of your seat, into the street, make with the feet. If you're a PVT, your duty is to salute the L-I-E-U-T. But if you brush the L-I-E-U-T, the M-D makes you K-B on the Q-T. This is the G-I Jive, man alive. They give you a private tank that features a little device called Blue Drive. Jack, after you revive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk, fall on your bunk, clunk. Thank you. They give you a private tank that features a little device called a fluid drive. Jack, if you still survive, chunk all your junk back in the trunk. Fall on your bunk, clunk. Soon you're counting jeeps, but before you count to five, seems you're right back digging that G.I.
When it comes to D-Day, usually if you were there, you only have to say one word. And in your case, it was Utah. Tell me about it.
There were only 11 of us. They were all demolition men. We were supposed to take out 4 heavy weapons in Normandy, overlooking Utah Beach.
So were you a parachuter?
Yeah.
Were you supposed to parachute?
Yeah.
And you did. You jumped out of the plane.
Yeah.
How far inland were you when you jumped out?
5 to 8.
So you landed in the hours before D-Day.
Yeah, one o'clock in the morning.
And so when you got there, you were already behind the heavy weapons, so you couldn't take them out. You were too far away. What did you do?
I landed in the top of a tree. I grabbed the tree. It's about a 50-foot tree. Slid right there. It was wet. And I slid right down, fortunately. And when I got to the bottom, this crowd had held fire with a burp gun. That's one of those 1,300 rounds a minute. He guessed where I was, and his guess was 2 feet over my head.
Could you hear the bullets?
Hear them. He's cutting the damn grass around my head. The trees, you know. A lot of shrubs and all.
What'd you do?
I was too scared to pee in my pants, so I didn't pee in my pants.
You had your encounter with someone trying to kill you the minute you landed. There was no delay. The second you landed...
Before. I didn't have my weapon out.
Had you ever been in battle before?
Nope.
And how old were you?
22.
So...
But I was an elderly 22. I got my rifle, put it together. I'm standing there on a road 20 feet wide, dirt, and nobody's around me. I'm alone on D-Day. Can you imagine? How the hell can you imagine that even? And I'm standing there, and I'm scared shit. I mean, I am scared.
Okay, so you're behind the lines of Utah, and about 3-4 hours later is when the invasion begins. Were you close enough to the beach to see it?
When I started, there were already people on the beach.
Could you see the ships on the horizon? Could you see them coming ashore?
Oh, you could see them coming in, yeah.
What was that like?
It's not something you can explain. You have to be there and see it, or it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable.
I've heard people say, both on the American side and on the German side, that when you saw the number of ships approaching the beach, everyone knew this was going to be the end of the war.
It's so big. It's bigger than you are. You can't even imagine. You start seeing stuff, but you see individual situations, explosions and stuff.
You were able to see what was going on the beach. Did you see people getting killed and the running and all that?
Well, you saw the aftermath of when they got hit.
So right away, you were engaged in, you killed people.
Personally, yes.
You shot people.
Yeah, the one guy.
The first time you shot, when you shot that man,
you don't even think about it.
Not in combat.
It's self-preservation.
Have you thought about it since?
A lot of times.
And what is...
It's the kind of thing that's quite personal. And I abhor violence. I was always the guy, if there was a little guy getting hurt, I was the guy that stepped in, because I was an orphan. I had more battles for other kids than I did for myself.
So I
was pretty good.
So you think about the fact that you had to kill people.
Oh, I loved combat when I was a kid. And when I got older, I abhorred it, you know.
How long did it take before you saw your first dead American?
I would have been with the Air Force guy.
And was it something that you just said?
It was up near that road, near the where the trees were being grown. That's the first guy.
It was one of those things where
he wasn't one of my men.
Yeah.
I don't know where he came from.
But it was one of those things where you said, I can't think about this now. I got to keep going.
You don't have time. Everything happens so damn fast, you don't have time to think. That could cost you your life.
Did you understand what an event this was? What a momentous event this was? Did you know...
All I gave a shit was I wanted to kill Hitler.
And get home okay?
I wasn't worried about that. That'll take care of itself, yeah. They murdered our men. And if they knew that I had blood coming out, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be there.
Do you sometimes think about your buddies who died?
Too often. I was supposed to be tough, and they'd see me off in the corner, tears coming down my cheek, and I never told them what it was about.
This was in later years?
Yeah.
What do you want to say? You know, your generation isn't going to be around in 20
years. I'm disappointed. Do you know that the young people today have not been taught the history of this country and all the crap that we went through? They haven't been taught that. They got these bunch of, what the hell do they call these guys, professors? If I ever got in a corner with them, I'd knock this. I'd start on their balls. We were told, don't try to help anybody. Don't bring nobody back to the ship. Get back here as fast as you can to get another load. We got to get manpower on the beach. The first wave I was on, and not a man survived out of that.
As the United States was recovering from the Great Depression, President Franklin D. Roosevelt initiated a work relief program known as the Civilian Conservation Corps. Many young men, like Sherwin Callender of Oakland, California, were quick to volunteer.
And they give us Army uniforms and barracks to sleep in, and we made campgrounds and fire trails and things like that. And all the different branches, recruiting officers had come to these camps and tried to recruit us into their branch of the service. A Navy man came, he said, you'll have a girl in every port. I said, sign me up. I was the first one. That's how I got in the Navy. I went through basic training in San Diego, California, and took what they called a Four Piper destroyer to Vallejo, California, and took that down through the canal and up the eastern coast to Belfast, Maine. Then I had to ride the train down to New York City to go aboard the USS Wright. Well, I took that down through the canal again and out to Pearl Harbor. We'd go to Midway and Wake Island. We'd carry men and material out to them both. And the last time on our way back from Wake Island, a carrier passed us. We're going the same direction. We were heading back to Pearl, and they were heading towards Pearl too. And we knew it was a carrier. It was at night, but we didn't know what nationality it was. Then the next morning, we heard over the news broadcast, they attacked Pearl Harbor. When we pulled into Pearl Harbor, I'd never seen such a mess in my life. And I've even had to pull bodies out of the water. One that gets me so bad that I'll never forget, I reached out and grabbed him by the hair, started to lift his body out. He was slipping. I reached over and grabbed his arm, and the meat just come right off the bone. I'll never forget that.
The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor inflicted more than 2,000 American casualties, and the U.S. went to war. Having experienced far more than he had anticipated, Sherwin requested a change of scenery.
I didn't want to mess with them Japs anymore, so I volunteered for amphibious training. They sent me all the way to Little Creek, Virginia, and that was the most vigorous training I ever went through.
His training complete, Sherwin was deployed across the Atlantic to take part in some of the first American campaigns in the war against Germany. Transporting units of the 1st Infantry Division, Sherwin would begin his combat experience in the invasions of North Africa and southern Italy. But the next operation would be the largest and most decisive yet, a chance to throw the gates of German-occupied Europe wide open.
Higgins boat a couple of times, and we were told, don't try to help anybody, don't bring nobody back to the ship, get back here as fast as you can to get another load. We got to get manpower on the beach. The first wave I was on, and not a man survived out of that. We had over 100 feet of clear beach, maybe close to 200 before you get any shelter. And the Germans was up on the hills bombarding us for at least 10 feet. The water was just blood red, bodies all over. Even dropped a gate down on top of bodies. Couldn't help it. And there was quite a few injured that we still couldn't bring them back because we had to get manpower on the beach. There was one young boy, he couldn't have been over 17. When we dropped off the load, he said, I want my mama. We couldn't stop to help him and bring him back or nothing. It was mean. That was the worst battle I believe I was in.
The invasion of Normandy was a success, and the Allies were finally on the offensive in Western Europe. But the war was not over for Sherwin. In August of 1944, news reached Sherwin concerning his brother Richard, a fighter pilot stationed in another part of the world.
My brother was flying P-38 over China, and his plane went down. And they never did locate it. They do have a memorial set in the ground there for him.
Despite the loss of his brother, Sherwin continued his service until the war's end. In the years since the Second World War, Sherwin has frequented schools and veteran events, sharing his story as a reminder of the cost of freedom. At the time of our interview, he was eagerly awaiting a trip back to Normandy for the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
I'm going back in June over there. That's going to be a wonderful trip.
Loaded on them boats and off of them boats for a week or 10 days every day. And each time we would be loaded on, we'd think, well, this is it. And to answer your question, was when we moved out and thousands of planes, it sounded like a roaring over our head, and we hadn't gone very far in that water until we could hear the artillery from the coast, the French coast. Then we knew that was the day that it was going to happen. It was heavy fog, and of course the sea was rough in A Company. They were the first ones to hit the Homeyall Beach, and that was the biggest percentage of them were wiped out. One of our chaplains went in on the same boat with me. He used to say, you try to save the, I'll try to save the souls. You try to save their lives and I'll try to save the souls. But see, a chaplain was in outfit. He had to be all, for the Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, and all. But he went back and turned to one of the men who fell and hollered for help. And he turned to pick him up, and I don't know what hit him, but his body went, and his head wasn't there. Just some things stand out in your mind that you don't try not to think about or talk about too much. I just have been so fortunate then and since then, with a good family and tries to thank God every day that, and you know, I'm one of a lot of people say, well, the Lord did this, the Lord did that. I don't think the Lord, well, take this chaplain that I'm talking about. Nobody can never convince me, because he was the only chaplain there to console and pray with these soldiers. I can't be convinced that the Lord jerked his head off and leave him without it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for a special announcement from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces from London, from Colonel R. Ernest Dupuy. Go ahead, London.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
This means invasion. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back at Columbia's news headquarters, the newsroom in New York. I've just taken the microphone out of the studio again and back into our news headquarters. You have just heard from London Colonel R. Ernest Dupuy of the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces reading communique number one. Everything to this point has been German reports, and communique number one now says, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. It is now official. The landings have begun, and at this moment here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
As you just heard from Mr. Trout, the period of doubt is at an end, and we have official announcement of the landing of Allied armies on the northern coast of France. As there is nothing to add to the very bare words of the official communique, it was to be expected that the Allied naval forces would cover the landing and would be engaged in conveying our troops to the coast of France, and that there would be strong air support. When there is any further details to give you, we will bring them to you promptly, and we'll try to analyze them for you as well as we can within the limits of the information that we get from time to time. Now, here again is Mr. Trout.
Major George Fielding Elliott has been speaking to you, talking about the invasion. I think we can now call it that, following the reading of the first communique, communique number one from SHAEF. That's what we call Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, somewhere in Great Britain. Rather strangely, you know, just before we switched to London to hear the first communique, we were making this informal tour of the Columbia newsroom, which began at 3 o'clock in the morning, 35 minutes ago. I was standing here in front of the OWI machine and telling you that while all the other news services, the UP, AP, INS, Reuters, all the rest, were sending out all these reports and from Europe, you know, about the German reports, the OWI, which confines itself to official news, sends us the text of the communiques and all that sort of thing. The OWI was printing almost nothing, and since the beginning of the day, since midnight, the OWI had put on only one bulletin, or rather one dispatch of any kind, saying that the Romanian radio reported enemy planes over Belgrade. And, of course, a few moments after I said that, we switched you to London so that you could hear Colonel Dupuy reading the communique, and, of course, at that moment, after I came out of the studio on the OWI machine, here is what is now printed. OWI 2, meaning the second bulletin since midnight. OWI 2, flash. Supreme Headquarters announces Allies begin operations on northern coast of France. Bulletin. Communique said, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. 3:34 p.m., Eastern wartime from Washington. That's what the Office of War Information wire says. Looking over the machines now in a way is rather speculative. The whole character of this broadcast has changed, and it did change rather abruptly. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, if you have been staying with us, you know we started, sometime after midnight. I guess it was about 20 minutes to 1 in the morning, Eastern wartime, when the Germans began putting these reports out. We've been bringing you frequent reports, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning, a little more than 35 minutes ago, we took this microphone here in our studio, which adjoins the Columbia Newsroom in New York, and brought it out here to the news machines and began taking you on an informal tour to show you what a newsroom is like at this hour. And now I hear that we must go to London in a few moments. Ladies and gentlemen, for a broadcast from Columbia's correspondent Edward R. Murrow, we take you now to London.
March with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeat in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. This order was distributed to assault elements after their embarkation. It was read by appropriate commanders to all other troops in the Allied Expeditionary Force. I return you now to the United States.
Now we're back at headquarters again in New York. At this moment, we're in the studio. As a matter of fact, we have to come into the studio now with this unusual arrangement so that we can hear the speaker and hear what Mr. Murrow was saying. That was Edward R. Murrow, Columbia's correspondent in London. Now we're back out in the newsroom with our long cable, and once again, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The Allied invasion of Western Europe, as you know, has begun. Such an operation carrying thousands and hundreds of thousands of troops across water to land them on a hostile shore is one of the most dangerous of all military operations. There have been few such vast military amphibious operations in all history. Some have failed, but some have succeeded. And no such operation has ever been prepared with the thoroughness of this Allied landing on the European continent. The Allies have been getting ready for it for years. The British have been looking forward to this day ever since Dunkirk. And the moment the United States got into the war, our military leaders realized that the main road to the defeat of Germany lay through the occupied lands of Western Europe, and they began to plan accordingly. Our leaders have also realized that they must strike with overwhelming force. In some military operations, an initial repulse might have little effect, but in this European invasion, it might be fatal, for it would be a disastrous blow to the morale of the people of the conquered nations. So, the plans for the invasion were more complex and more complete than any that military strategists have ever had to work out before. Germany's dash across the Low Countries and France was simple in comparison. So was the German attack on Russia, vast as that operation was. The Allied landings in North Africa and in Sicily involved similar problems to this one, but they were on a far smaller scale. The opposition was much lighter. Nevertheless, the experience gained in these operations has been invaluable in planning for this one. We don't know as yet the details of the first landing operations, but usually an invasion force strikes in three waves. First comes the assault force, which is composed mainly of infantry, supported sometimes by light tanks, and usually also including assault engineers. Its job is to strike quickly, to break up initial enemy resistance, and to secure a foothold on the shore. Before it can land, of course, it must have the support of bombing and fighting planes and of naval artillery. And you will remember that General Eisenhower's first communique emphasized the strong naval and air support which our landing was receiving. How quickly these first waves can get ashore depends on the strength of the enemy's defenses and on the effectiveness with which those defenses are reduced by bombardment.
We take you now in a few moments for another broadcast to the British Isles. In a moment or two, our signal will be ready. We take you now to London.
Here is the text of a report sent to London by Herbert M. Clark for the networks of the United States. This is Herbert M. Clark in a takeoff report from an Allied expeditionary base. I don't have to explain what the takeoff is. When you hear this, you'll know that Allied forces have leaped the gap between the bases in the United Kingdom and the coast of France. We'll be there, and we'll be there to stay as you listen. As I write this, we're in an unnamed port on an unnamed coast. One of the quirks of military security. But it's a funny thing about security. A week ago in London, I was in a state of constant irritation with security censorship. It was obvious from German radio reports that the Nazis knew things we knew but couldn't say. Since then, I've been living and eating and sleeping aboard the flagship of an Allied assault force, one of the several which are going to hit the Hun where he hurts most. And I find that Jerry knows less than he said he did. Since I've been here, we've had exactly one air alarm, and that not a raid or even a determined reconnaissance. And I also find that I don't object so much to security. My loyalty and responsibility to you back home is overridden by loyalty and responsibility to the soldiers on this boat and the sailors who are carrying them to the beachhead. That objective is also, for the moment, unidentifiable, because the place we've picked for our main landing is one Jerry hadn't figured on, and I don't want to be the one to tell him that our sector is the one where his counterattack should go. The Nazis have been badly outguessed on this whole show. He's going to be surprised by the direction of the attack, and he's going to get a shock by the timing. The master race has fallen down again. I'm treating all this in the past tense as though it had already happened. Maybe that's a mistake, but it's a reflection of the overwhelming confidence of the troops involved and the confidence I've drawn from the tremendous scale of the preparations. We haven't yet moved from our anchorage, but all morning, this coastal strip has been full of movement. Ladies and gentlemen, I will digress to say that the next few sentences will be semi-numerous to the fact that the script has been censored. There are ships in the task forces which are striking, British, Canadian, and American. They range from big troop carriers and supply ships down to landing craft. Other vessels, landing craft, which make most of the journey, piggyback on bigger ships, are in the fleet. Now I admit that I can't conceive of a fleet of ships myself, but I do know that's as far as I can see from the bridge of this ship. Others are dotting the water thickly, and I can see about 30 square miles of water. Well, ships, I'm told, half the force. Double it, and you'll have the hull. And they're all loaded with fighting men and fighting weapons, some of them still secret. With some hours, the vanguard of our force assigned to deal with specific coastal objectives in our sector of Nazi Europe, and landing craft lumbering through a choppy sea so slowly that they must start well ahead of time to get to their assigned places at their appointed times. These ships have been moving out. I'm speaking to shore by the last available channel of communication. We'll be following those ships soon, and I hope to be back with you before long with some harder facts. This is Herbert Clark reporting from the flagship of an Allied assault invasion force for the networks of the United States. I return you now to the United States.
It was low tide, and the beach was, my God, it was more than 300 yards from the low tide up to the, so we were still 20 or 30 minutes off of being in to where we dropped the thing. Mm-hmm. And when they would come by like this and just, I think it was kind of like stay out of our territory there, the machine guns kind of, and they would go across that thing up front and then hit water and stuff, and it was mostly fear they weren't going to kill us right then. But that's when I said, the guy said, how are we going to get out of this thing? I said, we're going in here, and the one that seems to be giving us the most, hitting us the most is up there. I'm going over the right side. And this is a matter of life and death. You don't need a boss to tell you this. You do whatever you think is right for you, but I'm going over the right side. Well, of course, most of my guys went over the right side. I think some of them who couldn't crawl over the thing to go over, tried to go down the ramp, and they didn't make it. And a couple of them we threw over it.
They got hit by machine gun fire as the ramp dropped, and they tried to go out the front?
As soon as the ramp dropped, they had zeroed in, and that whoever went down the ramp, some of them got hurt real bad, others got killed right there. Mm-hmm. But I'll bet you we were in 8 feet, and trying to get up with all this stuff to get a breath, you couldn't do it. So I just shed my pack and helped other guys I was trying to pull up out of there get up long enough to get a breath, and then they said, what about the pack? I said, don't worry about the pack. Of course, I didn't realize then, but there was plenty of packs to be found on the beach because guys were dropping. If they didn't drop in the water, they dropped them up there because you had to move fast on the beach. Mm-hmm. To pick up from here to the window would be a good gain on the beach where you had to hit the dirt again because of the machine guns. So it was getting off the boat was a mess. We should have drowned, and some of the boys did, but most of them I was able to get a hold of, or they would have to push me, and we'd get up over there. And you only had to go from here to the second coffee table because the bomb crater was like this. Mm-hmm. But getting breath to get up there was a big problem with all that mm-hmm. stuff on you. That's why we started dropping stuff there and, mm-hmm. and grabbing other guys and pulling them till they could get up and get a breath there. And that in itself was real scary.
Mm-hmm. Once you got on the beach, how did you get protection?
No protection when you're on the beach.
Okay, so are you seeing muzzle flashes?
Oh, yeah. Tracers. But what I was watching was a machine gun nest there and one here. This one seemed to have the best angle on us, and that one over there was apparently going this way and this way. So I was watching this, and when he would go by, I would make a run just because I'd drop my pack and everything else and sued my guys as hard as we could go, and if we could get from here to your wife, that would be good, and then hit the beach again because you knew he was going to be coming back with it. And when you hit the beach, you'd actually hit it so low your helmet would come off and roll there, and you'd try to grab it and put it back here, so you got hit there, and there was nothing to get down into. You're just, it would be like going to the beach to go swimming or something, but there was lots of pebbles and stuff on the beach too. And I saw guys get hurt bad with that. The machine gun missed them, went right by them, but in going by, it hit some of those pebbles and stuff, and just they exploded just like a grenade would explode, and the pieces of all the stuff with it, like this, and just cut them all up from the pebbles they didn't get, but they were hurt, and some lost eye problems and things from it, and some on the side of the head, I missed that, but there was no place else to go. You had no, then if you remember on the beach, you go up so far, and then there's a rock break, like a little rock break. My goal was to get to that rock break where I could look around and see where my guys were, because half my platoon was gone. We got on the boat went on the hole 24, I had 45 guys. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that boat was getting in. From then, I didn't know where my guys were. I only knew the ones I had, and I'm not going to tell you a number exactly because I'm not sure how many of them were already killed or badly wounded, so I'm fighting a platoon objective with maybe 15 or 20 guys at the most. Then I didn't think he's, well, by the time I got up to the cliff, I know I wasn't, I didn't have that many. But we're trying to get up to that rock break. I'm trying to keep them spread out because if they drop a piece of artillery in on us, whether it's a mortar? Whether it's a mortar or whether it's a shell from a 88, whatever drops on us, if we're all together, we're all going to keep spread out. And I didn't want to either. I want to be close to you because you and me are going to make it together. But I finally convinced them to stay apart because guys were dropping everywhere. And so some of us got up to that rock break, and then we kind of got together at the end of rock break and started deciding how we was going to get from here up to the wall, to the hill. So the reason I'm talking to you today is one of the ships from a mile at sea or more, maybe, finally got coordinates. They were afraid to fire before Kazewa dropped short on us. Mm-hmm. When they finally got enough coordinate information to know where they had to be, then they started firing. And then with the 101st Airborne coming in from the backup there, it diverted some of the stuff away from us, and that's why any of us are alive.
Okay, Art, obviously from the time your LCI, you know, approaches the beach, they're firing on you, the shells are hitting the MCI. You've got 24 of your 45 guys in your company on your LCI. And you're seeing men be killed.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible.
Emotionally, I mean, what did that do? What are you thinking?
You almost went brain dead. Like one of the guys grabbed right beside me at the moment. Before that, he grabbed one of those posts that the Germans had out there to keep the posts. And I didn't realize it then, but there was a mine on it. The machine gun came in and didn't hit him, but hit that mine and blew. It's not nice. There was nothing left of him. He was gone.
How close were you to that when that happened?
From here to that China closet. Mm-hmm. And then again, I was running, you know, as low as I could be, and most of it over me there, leftover shrapnel. Mm-hmm. And then going on the beach, I'm really close to a guy, probably from here to that first thing there, and I'm saying, spread out, keep spread out. And we saw it coming, or we knew it was coming, we could hear. And we both dove, and I hit the sand here, and he hit it there. When he landed his stomach on a landmine. When you land on it with your feet, it comes up like this and cuts you in half. When you land on it with your stomach, nothing. No dog tags, no arms, no legs, no nothing left but blood. Mm-hmm. Terrible. It's just terrible. Mm-hmm. Then you know you're at war. And now you're so scared you don't know, you keep fighting because you don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. And you know what real fear is. And you think, but I'm still alive. I can't go backwards. I mean, this all goes through your mind that fast. And if I'm going to stay alive, I can't be laying here. I got to, and between now and then, there's great officers who are up there somewhere hollering, come on, get off the beach. You're going to get killed anyhow. Get up here. Get away from the water. Get up here. And I'm thinking, these guys are right. I would make my 5 or 10 yards every chance I could. And the guys on my left or right, I'd say, go with me, but go off to the side. Stay on the side. And some of us got up there and some of us didn't. And medics were wonderful, but no medic in the world could cover the ground that had to be covered that day. You're working on this guy here, and I say, take care of him, I'm going to go. And I'd make my run and look back, and there'd be one there and one there. We had at least two medics on the ship with us, and if we had 15, there wouldn't have been enough. You just can't be every place. There was legs and arms and It's a bad thing to talk about.
Yes, I understand. To most contemporary Americans and people around the world, their impression of that is the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've seen that.
Mm-hmm.
What's your impression of is it accurate?
First time I saw it, I'll tell you, was accurate. I walked out. I couldn't. As soon as it got started like that, I walked out. I couldn't handle it. I probably waited a month, went back and sat through it, and I come out of there like this. And the first time I went back to the beach, I knew all at once I couldn't talk to the people I had taken here to show what happened, so I just acted like I lost something. I went walking down the beach, and I must have gone a couple or 3 minutes till I got a hold of myself and went back. So, and even today, when I was there last winter, it was or last fall, it wasn't, I choked. Just for a little bit. It's just.
Mm-hmm. So you think Steven Spielberg accurately portrayed what you guys faced?
So accurate.
I mean, it, as much as anything on setup like that could.
So accurate. It was scary accurate. But looking at it from that angle, it really scares you. I don't know that I was scared, but I was so scared I didn't know I was scared. You know, I knew. You know, we had to do, and you had to get it done, and you could stand there and get killed, or you, if you're going to get killed anyhow, you might as well do something about it. That's
we are Rangers true under red, white, and blue, and we fight for the right we adore. With our battle cry ringing through the sky, putting freedom on every shore. Well, when the Rangers come, there's no beat of a drum, but the flash of a cold steel blade. We'll fight, fight, fight for right, right, right. Just another famous Ranger raid. Got in the boat. When we pulled away, the water was rough and it was cold. And as we came in closer and closer to the shore, that's when we start seeing these 88s or what the hell they were flying over the top of us. You could see them, you know. Well, by that time, I had thrown up through my vomit bag. They gave us a bag, you know. And my job was to hook the grappling hook on the rockets to fire the rope up the cliff. When they told us to load up, you know the last thing I said to myself? I didn't say it to myself. I said it to the guy upstairs. I said, "Dear God, don't let me drown. I want to get in and do what I'm supposed to do. I'm starting to break down."
I was the last man off of my boat. Bullets were zipping by, but none hit me, thank God. I got a hold of the rope right in front of me and started up. And I got about two-thirds of the way up, and this hellacious explosion And the last thing that I saw was all of this mud, dirt, and rock coming down the cliff. And then I was knocked out. The next thing that I recall was I was buried up to about my waist. And I looked up and I could see this German up there and looking down like that. And he could have shot me right there if he wanted to, but I guess he figured I was gone, you know. So I looked around for my rifle. No, I had a Tommy gun. And it was some feet away, and I managed to squirm around and finally pull it out. And this fellow was still up there and looking around the other way, and I took a shot at him and pulled the trigger, and it snapped. My gun was clogged up with mud, and there I was. I remember saying to myself, ain't this a hell of a note? Here I am in the damnedest war in history, and I don't have a gun.
The first thing about the beach that you notice is there are dead men all over it. And the few that are still quivering are bleeding badly. There are a whole pile, and I actually literally mean a pile, of terrified men leaning up against the seawall, one on top of another, not beside each other, but on top of one another, trying to get into the cover there. You see puffs of dust as machine gun bullets and rifle bullets are hitting in your area. You hear the smack of bullets as they hit into the breakwaters, and you can hear them go whang off and as they ricochet, but you can also hear that thump as they hit a rock and scatter fragments of rocks all over the place. You would hear the artillery exploding behind you as they hit the boats on the waterline, the shoreline. And the rifle fire and the machine gun fire was just incessant as it cracked over your heads, as it hit into the breakwaters, as it chewed up the turf, as it banged into the road next to us. And it was one horrible noise after another with a lot of little nasty noises in between. And of course, when the artillery would hit near you, the whole ground would shake. You'd have dust and fragments and things like that come and litter around you. No, it was a scene from hell.
As our ramp went down, I'm the first one off the landing craft, and as I did, I was shot through the side, above my hip, through the muscle on the right side. Fortunately for me, my side was sore and hurt from the shot, but it didn't hit anything important. Bob, my radio man, was next to me on his rope, and we're struggling and about to make the top when Bob says to me, Len, can you help me? And I said, what's wrong? He said, I don't have an ounce of strength left. I can't make it. And it was only about a foot or two to the top of the cliff. And I said, Bob, now that you mention it, I don't think I have an ounce of strength left either to make it, but you gotta hold on. I happened to see Leonard Rubin. He was a very husky fella, and I yelled to him, Rube, get over there. And I said, Bob can't make it to the top. He's out of strength. Can you help him? With that, Rube throws down his weapon, reaches over, grabs Bob, and he is so powerful, my man. He jerked Bob up over the cliff, slung him over, and Bob's going through the air. In the meantime, I've gained enough strength to get up, and I'm standing up there with my submachine gun, protecting Bob and Rube. And the Germans and Rangers are being shot all around us. As we rushed them, we got to the gun positions that we were assigned, and there were no guns. What was there was these phony poles making it look from the air as if the guns were in those positions. I told my platoon sergeant, Jack Hume, you come with me. And I said, you're not going to go find those guns. They got to be here down this one sunken road. And we saw what looked to be wagon wheel tracks. We came to a hedge road. I had to look over into an apple orchard, a sunken apple orchard. And there, lo and behold, are the guns of Point du Hoc.
When you hear the cry of medic, there's no choice. You don't think about anything except you have to go. There's no choice, regardless of what's happening. You tended him and took care of him, if possible. If he was dead, you went on to the next guy. Later, it would hit. But at the time, nothing mattered except your job. But later on, every once in a while I think of Sergeant Otto in F Company, who I got along with very well and liked. He was on the top a very short time when he was hit in the belly. And the wounds, these wounds, like that, took just simply a hole in the abdomen. And nobody paid much attention to it. I mean, they didn't know any better. Didn't pay much attention to it. Just get to the medics and they'd take care of it. We had him in the aid station, what we made into an aid station. Well, I got him and I saw what it was and insisted he lie down. Typical of a wound of that sort is that the bullet will go in. And sometimes it'll go all the way through and it'll tumble and do extensive damage. The pain is enormous. We kept him under as much as we could with morphine. And eventually when we were relieved, of course, he was evacuated, but he died aboard ship. But I think of him every once in a while as I remember him. Because we were friends. These are men who live in your memory. But all this, the personalities, become frozen. They never develop. The people never develop. They're stopped in time and place. These were living human beings. Some of them a little nutty, some of them irritating. All of them were real. And the sacrifice is of all of these characteristics, all of this personality. All of the futures gone. All of the futures gone.
their words, their stories, their voices. I want to thank you guys for joining us this evening in our D-Day retrospective. Do it every year. And I think that it is, as I said in the teaser, it's very important that we preserve this thread within the national tapestry of our heritage, and that's why we do it. I appreciate you listening. We'll leave you now. We'll be back here probably Thursday or so, sometime at some point, doing something on a conservative perspective. And in the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you then.
Again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Yeah, we'll meet again. I don't know where, and I don't know when, but I do know that we'll meet again some sunny day. So honey, keep on smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive all the dark clouds far away. And will you please say hello to all the folks that I know, and tell them that I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song.
We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some fun.